Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Connecting Faith. You can hear the show live each weekday at noon Central Time, and there are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Neil Stavem. This is Connecting Faith at Ross at the Controls. Carissa is working the phones today and looking forward to chatting with you. As always, you're welcome to join us and get in on the conversation. Or you can call us at 877-93-FAITH, or you can always connect with us on Facebook. That's Faith Radio, and then look for Connecting Faith, or you can go to myfaithradio.com and then click on the Connecting Faith show page there for an email link. And we're having it's going to be kind of an all-star program, I think, is kind of how I'm thinking about it.
So. See what you did there because of tonight's big game.
Yes, we're ready. So I don't know, are you an all-star baseball fan? So.
A little bit. I'm not going down there. I'm avoiding the crowds and the traffic and the craziness. But yeah. Last night, the Home Run Derby went pretty late. They had a 45-minute rain delay and then actually got it done.
I watched Brian Dozier manage to get two.
Yeah.
And then I thought, okay, well, that's fine. I'll go to bed.
That was all you needed to see. Yeah, so. You know, another funny quick thing with that, there was an invite-only gala on the Mississippi River after the Home Run Derby ended, including fireworks, and the fireworks went off at 12:20 in the morning.
Oh, no.
Some social media tweets went out after that. People were not thrilled.
Maybe that wasn't quite such a good thing. So, but our guest today thought he'd watch a couple of innings. So, which is probably what most of us, if we have a particular favorite team, well, that's, you know, if we see our player play, sure. That's probably about it.
It is the best of the best, you know, gathering and playing. So, it's worth taking it.
Good. Our guest today, we've chatted with him before, and I'm happy to have him back on Connecting Faith. And anytime we have an opportunity to talk, I just appreciate Alec Hill, who's president and CEO of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. And you know, obviously, students are off across the country getting their summer break from classes. But there's a question about, you know, ministries, whether they'll actually get back on campus this fall. Particularly, some four-year public universities have really been clamping down. And, you know, you've heard us talk about it in the morning show as well. Just, you know, what's happening in terms of freedom to meet for worship and Bible study on campus. And so yesterday was a day set aside to focus on campus access, as InterVarsity Christian Fellowship President Alec Hill declared a day of prayer for campus access. And so that's where we want to start. And just welcome back Alec to the broadcast. He has been with InterVarsity Christian Fellowship since early mid-90s, maybe? Or is it
2001.
2001. And we appreciate Alec. He's written the book Just Business, Christian Ethics in the Marketplace, which we may get to a little bit later on. And there's a great new piece that he wrote in this issue of Christianity Today that we'll talk about, focusing on Inside My Slavery, How Jesus' Most Troubling Parable Finally Made Sense to Me. So, Alec, all that to say, welcome. And let's talk about this day of prayer, maybe as a way of reviewing what the situation is. And I think we've talked in the past when there have been other challenges, but this is particularly what for the California state system, right?
Yeah, this is the big one. The California state system is a 23-school, 450,000-student behemoth, and they enacted a new policy a year plus ago, and it basically said that student groups can't discriminate in selecting leaders based on faith, and that's fine for most groups, but for faith-based groups, of course, that's catastrophic. To date, there have been some private schools like Vanderbilt and Bowdoin in Maine that have gone this direction, but they're just a handful. It's a small number, but the Cal State system represents, like I say, the big enchilada And this will be a huge tipping point. You know, to be clear, we don't have membership requirements. Any student can come and participate. But say you have a chapter of 100 students, we want the five leaders to be exemplars in terms of their faith and their conduct. And the university with this new policy is saying, nope, you can't select your leaders based on faith criteria. In other words, it's democratic. Anyone can run. And we find that to be really hard. And what for? We're a creedal movement, and so what it's basically saying, we insist that any student leader assign our doctrinal basis, and the university is saying as a precondition that's unacceptable.
So would there be other, I guess, as you say, creedal movements that, you know, would be faced with the same kind of issue? I mean, it's hard to imagine that a Muslim group or something certainly wouldn't want a Christian leader in that respect.
Well, we are at the moment trying to set up a meeting with the new chancellor in the California state system, and that was part of the day of prayer that meeting would occur. One of the groups that will go in with us will be the Muslim Student Association, because like us, they have a set of beliefs, and this is not just a Christian issue, or even just a Protestant or evangelical issue. It's a faith-based issue, and frankly, even more broadly than that, it's an association issue. So theoretically, the Young Democrats can't pre-screen out Republicans from running for their positions. But the reality is, it's much more onerous on faith-based groups, because we take our creed, we take our beliefs so seriously.
So. Would they have any requirements? I mean, can you have any requirements? It's simply that it just can't be tied into faith, right?
Well, faith is religious discrimination, which is kind of almost incredible to think about it, saying that religious faith-based groups can't use religious discrimination in the selection of their leaders. That's one of the categories, like gender or like ethnicity now, that is prohibited in this new policy. And it just really ignores the First Amendment's special protection for religious groups throughout the history of the country. It's a little Alice in Wonderland-like. The odd thing about the new policy, it exempts Greeks, that's fraternities and sororities, from gender discrimination. So it's really peculiar to me. It's as if the First Amendment were replaced with protecting fraternities and sororities. And my theory on that one is they're just so powerful in terms of their influence that the Greeks got the exemption and the religious groups did not. But that's the hypocrisy of the policy.
Well, as you said, it's sort of Alice in Wonderland. I mean, it's the emperor doesn't have any clothes. Any number of those, I guess, this doesn't really have basis in logic, does it? I mean, it's just we wonder how this has gotten to where it has come to be.
Well, about a month ago, the New York Times had a front page article on this situation, and we were nervous, but the article turned out to be quite strong in favoring our position. And likewise, then it was really interesting. A few days later, Mother Jones, which is a very liberal group out publication out in the Bay Area, came out in our support. As did the National Review, very conservative. So it was funny having those publications all agree on an issue, and I doubt that's probably ever happened before. But you know, to say the Mother Jones article headlined it, it said basically, "Let the Christian groups have Christian leaders," and I thought that captured it pretty succinctly.
Give us a little, because I know you mentioned Vanderbilt University. I mean, this is not something new for you, but I'm wondering, you know, if these restrictions have sort of changed in the last few years, or has this kind of morphed? Provide us maybe a little context perspective on how this is. It seems like as you said, this is really we're at a tipping point now.
Well, we saw the first one of these leadership requirements back in Rutgers in 2002-2003. And then we saw it in the University of Wisconsin system in 2006. So it's kind of been creeping up as an idea that religious discrimination should be forbidden. But then in 2010, the U.S. Supreme Court had a very narrow decision. It was called Hastings or Martinez. It's a law school, public law school in the Bay Area. And it basically said that if a public institution has an all-comers policy, meaning anybody can be leader of any group, then they might consider that to be acceptable. And in the particular case, they did. Well, as you can imagine, at the time, there were only two schools in the whole country that had all-comers policy, a state school in Maine and then Hastings Law School in San Francisco. Well, since that time, a lot of schools have tried to play with that. Thankfully, most schools like Ohio State came up and they looked at all comers and they said, my goodness, sororities, fraternities, athletic teams? I mean, are we really going to require our rec teams to be co-ed? Glee clubs that are divided by gender, academic societies that basically discriminate based on intelligence. So they backed away. And most schools followed that. And it wasn't until Cal State I believe it was 2011, 2012, with the former chancellor, came up with this policy. And that's why I say it could be the leading edge, or it could be a trial balloon that doesn't work. It's looking to me a little bit more like the former than the latter, but we're still very much in a point of disequilibrium in how this is going to tip.
Well, it's maybe not exactly the same, but I guess we hear and read articles about speech codes on campus, you know, what can be said and what can't be said. I mean, that's pretty similar. This is an odd situation, isn't it, in an institution of higher education where sort of learning is supposed to be the, all ideas should be open, right, that we've come to this point.
For the audience, I'd say try to look up Michael Bloomberg's talk at Harvard University. He gave the commencement address. You can just Google it. And of course, Michael Bloomberg is left of center, but he took Harvard to task because of their censorship of various ideas, not only political but religious. So I think what happens is universities can get into a group think, and they talk a good game about pluralism. But actually, it's getting to be a lot more what's known as monism, that is sort of one view predominates. And what we're arguing for is what we call principled pluralism, and that is that we don't have to agree with each other, but we have to give space in the public square for us to make our points. And if we don't behave civilly, then we should get kicked out of the public square. But if we behave civilly towards each other, then the university of all places should be a place where disagreement is welcomed.
We want to come back in a moment and talk a little bit more about pluralism. There's an article in World Magazine not too long ago that addressed that issue, and I want to get Alec's perspective on it. Alec Hill is my guest. He's president and chief executive officer of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, and he has several degrees from the University of Wisconsin Washington School of Law, as well as an MA in Biblical Studies and a BA in History from Seattle Pacific University. You were talking to us today about what's going on at the InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, what's going on campus today, and we'll get to even some questions about how we as parents might be able to help our kids be better prepared as they head off to college and university this fall and to be able to stand strong for their faith. More on that coming up. If you'd like to join the conversation, by the way, if you are been part of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, has played a difference, made a difference in your life, love to hear from you. It might be an opportunity maybe as a parent to say, the IV chapter on my child's school made the difference for them. It kept them strong. It'd be a great time for you to just call and say, hey, and thanks to Alex. You can call us at 877-93-FAITH, 877-933-2484.
Faith, 877-93-FAITH.
Talking about the freedom to gather, to worship, to study around God's Word, and how that's being challenged today all across university campuses, colleges across our nation. Interesting time in which we live. Yesterday, University Christian Fellowship was encouraging believers all across the country to join in a day of prayer for campus access, particularly for the California State University system, which is a large university system and represents in many ways kind of a tipping point on what the student groups, ministry groups will be allowed. Alec Hill is talking to us today. He's president and chief executive officer of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. If you've been an IV member in the past, or maybe your kids were or are, and it's made a difference in their life, we'd love to hear from you and give Alex a call and just say thanks for the good work of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. We appreciate their diligence and insight and encouragement over the years. 877-93-FAITH is our phone number. 877-933-2484. Alec, you mentioned just talking a little bit about pluralism, looking for trying to find some opportunities there to let the marketplace determine speech, and as long as we're well mannered. But it's interesting. World Magazine, Joe Belts had a column the other day. He was talking about how pluralism can be a problem when the emphasis is on that all views are of the same value. And maybe you encountered that too. I mean, you're coming with propositional truth into a marketplace where truth isn't really valued so much anymore.
Well, an important distinction needs to be made between syncretism on the one hand and pluralism on the other. Syncretism is a mishmash of faith. We see it in the Old Testament when the people came back from exile and the Samaritans were there. And, we certainly see it in the world today, a little Dalai Lama, a little Jesus, a little, C.K. Rowling. That's syncretism. So we, as Christians, we believe in an absolute truth, and that can't be. Pluralism is an idea that it doesn't necessarily say that all views are equal. It just says that they all have a right to speak at the table. So I think I can be non-syncretistic as a believer, but advocate pluralism at the university level where different views can be. And I think one of the words that's often misused is tolerance. Tolerance used to mean that if you and I disagree, we may even believe each other's going to hell, but we treat each other with respect, we're friends, we're civil, we're kind, we stand up for each other. The new tolerance is if I make you feel unsafe in any way, I have to lower my definition of truth. And if I don't, then I'm a bad person. So the new tolerance is this very low-grade sense of homogenous, bland spirituality. And I just see this word being abused so much right now. Another word is discrimination, which is being abused too. So people have taken words that were healthy words and have really morphed them into something for their own agendas.
Well, words, still have meaning and still have value, but I mean, it seemed like we're in a point where, the standards, the basics, even the idea of logic is kind of slipping by us.
Well, the flip side of religious discrimination that Christian groups or religious groups can't select their own leaders is the freedom of association, which is also in the First Amendment, that groups get to self-define and they get to have their own identity. And that means that they can say, this is what our leaders should be like. So by just throwing out the word discrimination or tolerance or pluralism, it's almost as if in the media now you can just wipe the other side off the board, where these words have been redefined in such a way that they really ignore, downplay, like I say, freedom of association, freedom of faith, and those values. It's a shame that the media has tipped that way. Mm. Our culture has tipped that way.
Yeah. Is this coming from, would you say, upper levels of, university leadership, so chancellors and, that level, or is this something that's from the professors, or is this sort of bubbling up from the students? I mean, is this a top-down or down bottom-up?
Do you mean the policy itself?
I assume that everyone says if you influence the influencers, then the rest of us are going to follow. So I guess is this just some ideals from leadership professors that say we need to not discriminate, we need to be tolerant, we need to have speech codes, those kind of things?
I think the basic environment in universities today sets the tone, and that tone is, as I'm describing, it's a lot less pluralistic than they would like to think. It's a lot more narrow-minded than they would like to think. And that then gives permission, if you will, to administrators, who I love, by the way. I was a former business school dean, so I have no axe to grind with university administrators. But it gives select people the language then and the culture to operate in to put out policies like the Cal State policy, which if it had come up through a public forum, for example, I think could have been blown out of the water. But it appeared. It was issued late in the last chancellor's regime. It's an executive order policy. And so in that sense, I guess I'm answering your question two ways. One is there's a culture in the university world which foments this kind of thinking, but then often the policies come from one person or one team or one department, and then they're imposed broadly.
Is it a fear to for other universities to sort of stand up and change the rules? I mean, I guess we've heard illustrations where a university president or something may suggest in a speech that there are differences between men and women, and that they get criticized roundly.
Well, Michael Bloomberg in his Harvard address, which I referred to earlier, chastised the Harvard folks because he said, "Look, as leaders, as faculty members, administrators, and VPs and presidents, you have to be a referee." And you may have read about a number of speakers at commencements that were disinvited in the spring, and they were on the left and the right. I mean, it was both sides. And presidents have to step up. Provosts have to step up and say, look, we may not agree with this voice, but we're going to let this person speak, and we're going to protect that person from being chanted down or being accused of this or that. And what really needs to happen is university leaders need to step up and play that role. And that's a call. I mean, it's not just coming from folks of faith. It's coming from the secular world as well. And I think it'll be uneven in the response.
Do you have a sense that professors, those on staff at universities, have the opportunity to communicate their faith openly as well? Or is this just an issue at this point among student ministry groups like InterVarsity?
No, well, we are also a faculty ministry. We have 50 faculty chapters, and it's one of our fastest-growing areas. So actually, we're deeply embedded in faculty. And I see kind of a dichotomy. I see tenured faculty. One of our board members is a professor at the University of Virginia. His name is Ken Elzinga. Very outspoken about his faith, regularly speaks in ministry groups, writes articles, is well-known for his Christian faith, and respected for it. And as a tenured member, he's protected and relatively outspoken. But I see for the dichotomy is the non-tenured faculty who I worry about, that if they speak out on their faith, for example, there's nothing in a code or anything that would prevent them from getting tenured. But they also worry that they're going to be perceived in certain lights, whether it's being anti-intellectual or narrow or, you name it, judgmental. And so I do think for non-tenured faculty, the chilling effect is real.
You mentioned you have a faculty chapter. There are a number of different aspects to InterVarsity. Maybe just take a minute to sum up some of the work outreach that you're doing.
Yeah, thanks. The main thing we do is we have 1,000 campus chapters right now, just about 1,000. We're heading up that number. And these are largely either student-led or faculty-led groups. Our staff serve as coaches, so we have a strong emphasis on that. And they're groups that provide Bible studies, that provide care. About 25% of the students who come are not believers, and they self-identify that way. We've seen a doubling of the number of new believers in the last 10 years. So as much as we wail and are woeful about the university campus, we're seeing remarkable fruit right now. So that's the main thing. That's the core of what we do, which is student and faculty chapters. Secondly, we do missions, and so Urbana, we have a conference every 3 years with 16,000 to 18,000 students who come to St. Louis. It's a big deal, and we do global projects during the summer and urban projects all year round, helping with literacy and justice issues. We also have InterVarsity Press, which I suspect most people listening would know about. We do about 100 books titles a year. I love InterVarsity Press. And then we have camps and the like. So I like to look at it as a tree, that our core ring is our campus ministry, and then we have several extension ministries beyond that.
We'll talk more about effective outreach on campus and maybe some encouragement for parents today. Say, I've got a student heading off to school, or maybe it's years down the road, but I want them to be able to stand strong for their faith on campus. We know all the statistics. We'll get some perspective on that from Alec Hill, who's the president and CEO of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, joining us today. You can join us at 877-93-FAITH.
So if I stand, let me stand on the promise that you will pull me through. And if I can't, let me fall on the grace
You're listening to Connecting Faith, 32 past the hour. We've connected today with Alec Hill, who's president and chief executive officer of InterVarsity Christian Fellowships. Been in that position since 2001. He, before that, served as dean of Seattle Pacific University's School of Business and Economics. And before that, he was a professor of law and ethics and has written the book in Just Business, Christian Ethics in the Marketplace. And we'll touch on that in a bit as well. Alec, we've been talking about the opportunities and some of the challenges of ministries on campus. And it made me wonder, and I don't know if you have a sort of a good answer, but, you know, have we changed? Has the definition of what higher education is changed? I mean, we, I guess, always thought that it was an opportunity to consider all sorts of ideas and maybe center around some core principles that are truth. But that's maybe not the situation anymore.
Well, another way to look at it is for campus ministries, at least in the 50s and 60s, going a long ways back, it was very unclear about our status on campus. And then in the 70s and 80s, there were several lawsuits that allowed to give us protection to go on. And now, as I mentioned, the 2010 Supreme Court decision, we're seeing some erosion. So we can be a little hyperbolic sometimes about the eroding university world. At least for us as campus access, it's been this sort of detente that we've had because of legal decisions. In terms of a culture in general, which the university world is part of, yeah, I think there's definite drift away from towards a relativistic worldview, towards everything being equal, towards a syncretistic kind of blur. And anybody who stands up for anything really is going to get shot at. It's, you know, this generation, as much as I like it, they've been brought up on the like button on Facebook, and it's hard sometimes for them to stand up and say, this is true, and I'm going to take hits for it. We do see examples of that, but it's hard for them.
So given that, how do you stand up and say this is true when it comes to sharing the gospel? And what is maybe effective, or how has the strategy changed for sharing Christ on campus?
You know, as I mentioned earlier, we've just seen really an astounding sort of response to the gospel in the last 5 or 10 years, just numbers that we've never seen before. And so we're very excited about that. And I think some of the keys with the millennials is that they're all looking for a community to which to belong. And we have a phrase that we say, belonging before believing. So you create environment where they can come in and they can seek, and often that's just an inductive small group Bible study where they can, it's student-led, and they can sit in a dorm with six other students, and they can ask their questions as they look at a teaching of Jesus, for example, and they love that. International students love that too. By the way, we have about 800,000 international students in this country, and we're seeing them respond as well. This generation is also missional, so you can appeal to their idealism, to their sense of changing the world. And as you mentioned, they're also big into justice. And so we have projects like out of Boston where 500 students will get on a bus and go to New Orleans. We've been doing this for nearly a decade now, and half the students are not Christian. And it's defined to be a service project. They go down and they do building stuff. But they're having conversations on the way down. They're meeting with church people in New Orleans, and they're talking on the way back. And obviously that's going to have a huge impact on folks. So these are sort of the positive approaches to reaching this generation. And we're really seeing the Lord bless it. So in some ways, I feel a little like Charles Dickens. It's the best of times in terms of evangelism and outreach. It's the worst of times in terms of campus access.
To get to that place where you welcome all, I mean, to be welcoming, to allow people to belong maybe before believing, I mean, that probably would challenge some of us long-term you know, fundamentalists, maybe, that, you know, we're so focused on that truth component that it's hard to sort of think in maybe that seeker mindset.
Well, I hope I communicated well. What we're saying is come into a Bible study, come to large group, go with a friend to church, kick the tires, test this out, go on a project with us, do a service project, you know, and just see if this Jesus thing is real. One of the great ideas that I heard recently from one of our teams, and we do a lot of inductive sort of brainstorming, is they said, the pilot was, imagine you're a Christian for a month, what would you do? well, you'd read the Bible, you'd pray, you'd go to church. And so these are for non-Christians. So I thought that was pretty creative. So we're trying to find pathways for them to connect with the faith. Now, of course, they aren't eligible for leadership yet. I mean, they have to mature and they have to grow. But, you know, when you look back in our history, someone like Tim Keller, who came to as a freshman in college, was a non-believer, became a Christian in his sophomore year at Bucknell, and then became a chapter president or leader by senior, and then came on InterVarsity staff for 3 years. And, of course, we know how Tim Keller has gone from that point on. Or Gary Haugen of the International Justice Mission and how his faith grew at Harvard through our chapter and his first global experience and all that. So we try to, in discipleship, we try to take people where they are, which is often very much even in the pre-seeker stage, and help them along the path.
There has always been, perhaps, I'm sure it maybe hasn't been on your part of not working with the local church, but there's probably been some questions perhaps from churches in university and college neighborhoods to say, well, you know, the kids want to do their chapter meetings, but they don't want to come to church.
Well, it's interesting. We track every year, and like I say, about 25% of our students are non-Christians, and 75% of our students go to church. And so that means that the Christian kids are going to church. We require it of our leaders, our staff. We make it very clear that we're an outreach mission, that we're not the parish church, and we don't compete. We don't do, except for the occasional conference, we don't try to run events in conflict with church. And like I say, we keep track of it. So I can't speak for the other campus missions, although I think I can. I think we all feel that there's no substitute for the local intergenerational church, and we're not trying to be the substitute for that.
I want to talk a little bit about an article that you wrote here in the latest issue of Christianity Today, Inside My Slavery, How Jesus' Most Troubling Parable Finally Made Sense to Me. And I'm wondering if we can just maybe unpack that a little bit, and thinking in terms of as you've seen the gospel presented on campus over the years, and have we maybe missed some key parts of it, and is this an opportunity for us to just see a bigger picture of what it means to be a follower of Christ?
Well, the article is based on an obscure parable in Luke 17 where a slave comes in from the field after working all day, and then he does a double shift, and Jesus asks, does the master thank him? The answer is no. Does the master say, sit down and eat before you do your second shift? No. And the punchline of it is, so you also, when you have done everything you were told to do, should say, we are unworthy slaves, we've only done our duty. I jokingly write in the article that if I had a pair of scissors like Thomas Jefferson, I'd probably excise it from the text, because it's so offensive, particularly in light of our history of slavery. American slavery was so abusive and awful. But when you get past that and you think about this, why did Jesus use this image? In the Gospels, he says, take up your yoke. No slave can serve two masters. If I, your master, have washed your feet, do likewise. A slave is no greater than his master. And then Paul, of course, used the slave, the master, which is kurios, and slave, doulos, as his favorite phrase for himself. And the first century church used the slave language a lot. So for me, it was getting past sort of the American ugly heritage of slavery and thinking, why did Jesus use this metaphor, and how does it apply to me?
And I know that even as you set up the article, you know, someone in a different culture, Nigeria, for example, would look at this maybe completely different than we often do.
The Nigerian friend I reference said this is one of his favorite parables, and I looked at him just sort of, with a shocked face. But this idea that, clearly God is our Father. Jesus is our Redeemer. He calls us friends. All those things are true, and we hear that all the time in church, sermon after sermon. What we don't hear is another voice, which is the master-slave language, and it's as if we're deaf to it. We just can't hear it. I think part of that is sort of a boomer narcissism, I'll speak for myself, that it's really the gospel's all about me. But part of it is the American Civil War experience and slavery, and we just don't want to go near this imagery. but it's there. I mean, I in writing this article, I knew it might be misunderstood by some, but the reality is that this is Jesus teaching this parable. I mean, do we ignore it or do we try to grapple with it? So I chose it's been about the last 10 years, and of course it grew out of a leadership crisis in my own life, that I just it was so liberating to realize I have a good master who's all powerful and all good, and that I only have to do what I can do. I can't do more than that. I'm not responsible. So with the California state system, one of the reasons for the day of prayer was to say, okay, Lord, we're doing our duty, we think, which is a lot of different chores. But in the ultimate sense, we can't control the situation. So, Master, please fix this. I fasted yesterday. A lot of us did. And we still don't know the outcome of what it's going to be.
Just to come to that place of what does it mean to surrender, I guess, to see, you know, who we are, but also to know that, you know, we do have a loving Heavenly Father. We probably have missed on that sometimes as well.
Well, to be honest with you, I think in our culture, in American evangelicalism, we do pretty well with a loving Father, Abba perspective, and rightfully so. And it is the predominant view, and I don't mean to mitigate it. But I think that this sense of the transcendent, almighty, holy God, and we are puny, sinful humans, I think sometimes we miss that perspective. And that's when we're on our face before God saying, have mercy on me, a sinner. And Master, I love you, I serve you. So in the article, I talk about a four-voice choir, and I think all of those voices have to be sung, or you end up with out of tune, or at least an incomplete voice.
And has it? I mean, as you've sort of gone back, and maybe even just doing the article, looking back and say, how is my life, how am I living out my faith different as a result? I mean, is it more you're more at rest? I mean, or you're still. You know, doing your part, but you know, not trying to do more than your part.
Well, it's been a radical change, actually. I think I am a type A person, and I have always been an achiever, and always thinking that I can control things and I can fix everything. And I think it wasn't until I got into this job. We have 1,600 employees. It's a big ministry. And I realized about 9 years ago that things were broken, that I actually contributed to the breaking of, I couldn't fix. And it was pretty devastating on me. And it took me to a place of this parable where every day for the last 9 years, during my quiet time, I say, I'm your slave. And it's a corrective for me, having been so self-centered and so self-willed that I can do anything and accomplish it. And this is just it's a corrective on failure. I think for some people, Luke 17 isn't needed because they already have some of these attributes. I lack them almost completely. Submission, obedience, slave. Come on, that did not describe me at all. So I think I've had to learn a great deal. I'm probably phase two out of who knows how many phases I have to go. But I'm certainly it's not just a small shift, incremental. This is a paradigm shift for me.
Well, I think all of us could benefit from some serious reflection and consideration on that. And I'd recommend the article to you in Christianity Today, Inside My Slavery, How Jesus' Most Troubling Parable Finally Made Sense to Me, from Alec Hill. Alec's my guest today. We're talking about all things on campus and more about walking in faith. In submission and obedience, what that looks like. You're welcome to join the conversation, too. By the way, if you've been an IV member, or maybe you have one of your kids who's been in a chapter, I'd like to just say thanks for the good work that they're doing. You can certainly express that to Alec here in a moment. 877-93-FAITH is the phone number. It's 877-933-2484. Alec Hill's president and CEO of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. Coming back in a moment, we're going to talk a bit about those walk-away years when kids leave the faith. We got some perspective from Alec on what we might do as parents to help our kids in that area, as well as a touch on a book that he wrote here a few years back called Just Business, Christian Ethics for the Marketplace. And we'll get some practical insight and help there as well. It's all coming up here on Connecting Faith.
Weekday afternoons at 1:30.
Somebody needs a life to have. Whatever you do, just don't
There are 1,000 campus chapters of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship having a significant impact for decades. In fact, does it go back, Alec, to the 40s beginning? When did
Yeah. 1941.
It's an amazing ministry and a number of various outreach aspects to it, and the Urbana Student Missions Conference is one of those truly life-changing experiences, and I would encourage you, if you have college-age kids, that you would recommend and send them there. We're going to talk a little bit about Marketplace Ministry as well. It's an area that Alec cares a lot about as well. He has served as the dean of the Seattle Pacific University School of Business and Economics for a time, and was a professor of law and ethics, and he's now president and chief executive officer of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. Has been in that position here since 2001. And Alec, I want to go back to just a little bit about kids leaving their faith. I mean, we hear the statistics, you know, various versions, I guess, of them, but there is this period, it seems like, from maybe, you know, the time they get their driver's license or they get their marriage license, that they're sort of wandering away. And I mean, I'm sure you see that, and that's a concern for IV chapters. What do you recommend for parents that are concerned about that?
Yeah, I've seen the same surveys you've probably seen, Fuller Seminary and others, that 60 to 80% of the high school seniors will walk away for at least a period of time from their faith while they're in college. One of the troubling trends is that by 30, it seems like fewer are coming back, and that grows to be a concern. I think as a parent, speaking now in that role, what we'll call biblical literacy is pivotal, and that is, does your child know Scripture, and not just listening to others teach, but actually gone through Bible studies and is able to perhaps even memorize Scripture. I think that creates a Kara Powell of Fuller Seminary calls it sticky faith and intergenerational activity, but I think the key is biblical understanding. The other thing is, if you have a junior or senior, when you go on college visits, try to connect with the campus ministries. Look up on the websites and find Navigators and Crusade and InterVarsity and others, and try to make those connections. Now, sometimes your high school student may not appreciate that because they want to go independent, but it's still a wise thing to do. And also, you might ask your pastor for contacts, depending on what school your child is going. So those are just some parental things that I would pass on.
And of course, those, I mean, it's probably the earlier the better, right? I mean, in terms of, if you wait till you drop them off on campus for them to hope to run into a IV staffer or something, that it might be, it's going to be a lot tougher then.
Well, it's going to get tougher because if we don't have tables for freshmen like we do on most campuses, if that campus access becomes an issue, it will be harder for them to find us than it is right now on most campuses. So, but I would be proactive as a parent. I'd be shameless about finding names and contacts once your child has decided to go to a particular university or college, and I would try to build people around. And of course, you have to be sensitive to your kid who wants independence from you after all. It depends on your relationship with him or her.
You know, Alec, maybe you can follow up and explain what does it mean if you do not have campus access? I mean, what does that mean for a ministry like InterVarsity or Navigators or Crusade?
Yeah, I was going to come back to that, so thank you for doing so. Basically, loss of recognition means that we can't meet on campus for free. So currently, and this was a 1970s Supreme Court decision, we're allowed to use campus facilities. We're allowed to post on campus for the meetings and let people know. We have access to freshmen at freshman orientation, which is a big deal. If freshmen don't get connected in their first 2 weeks, it's much, much harder to reach them afterwards. And then just psychologically, being part of the community means that if you go to the university website, there's InterVarsity. We're part and parcel of what we call the pond, the university, and we're one of the animals or plants that lives there. The counterbalance to that is at Vanderbilt, where we've been de-recognized along with 13 other ministries. We have to meet off campus. Telling students about our meetings and the Bible studies is much more difficult and challenging. We're doing it. So de-recognition does not kill ministry, it just hampers it. And if it's the wave of the future, I hope it's not, we are having lots of conversation about adjusting to that new reality.
And, I mean, everybody is this primarily just faith-based ministries that are being faced with the derecognition at this point?
Well, in theory, let's say you're a Latino group, and you basically assume that your leadership will always be Latino. Well, often you may just sign the form and kind of, you know, look at each other and smile because, you know, 100% of your people are Latinos, and you know you're going to. But in theory, it could mean other groups based on political ethnicity. The rape relief group, for example, theoretically would have to have a former rapist be able to run for president. He wouldn't have to elect him, but he'd be able to run. So theoretically, it applies to other groups, but it hits religious groups the most because I do think, you know, there's a core set of beliefs in our leaderships that just have to be met, and they're non-negotiables. And I think it's that fight for orthodoxy that's so passionate with us that is less passionate in the secular groups.
You know, speaking of
that's you know, we're just different. I mean, religious groups are just different in that regard.
You know, speaking of core beliefs, you know, I was talking a little before the program here. You kind of wonder sometimes in terms of what kind of education students are actually getting on some of these you know, campuses. If there's you know, kind of this speech code, tolerance, focus. And, you know, we don't necessarily center around truth or, you know, objective standards. You've written a book called Just Business, Christian Ethics for the Marketplace. I know it's been revised. But, you know, are you concerned about, you know, the students that are coming out with a business degree without having sort of been centered on any sort of business ethics?
Well, back in the 1990s, in the dark ages, the accrediting body said that every business program had to have an ethics component. Well, at my university, we already did, of course, as a Christian school. But it's been interesting to watch how those programs have evolved over a couple of decades. And I remember reading one study that said that actually by teaching ethics the way it's being taught, a lot of students come out making worse ethical decisions because they've been taught, well, here's three options, the utilitarian, the Kantian, and maybe one other. And then they learn it's multiple choice, and they apply whichever logic they want to rationalize the decision. That's pretty disturbing. So I applaud the Academy for trying to get ethics into the curriculum. But the reality is when you don't have a truth base for ethics, you know, I mean, even the Greeks or the Chinese or the Hebrews, they all had ethical bases. When you don't have that, which the university world is really struggling to define what it is, when you don't have a core, what do you got to teach on? You have no foundation.
Are you, in that respect, concerned? Are you hopeful, or are you maybe pessimistic?
Well, I think it's good that public or state universities and private universities are teaching ethics. I think it raises good questions, and I think on some campuses they actually look into religious teachings, and so they might go to the Quran or the Talmud, Sermon on the Mount, and I think all of that is good, even though it can start smacking a little bit of syncretism that, you know, which I don't like. But the problem is when you don't have sort of eternal verities that you aren't ascribing to truth. Like I say, it's all quicksand. So I'm a little bit of a skeptic that it's really going to produce much other than articulate folks who can rationalize behavior through a new lens.
Wow, that's what I want in my degree, right? Articulate, I can just rationalize. Yeah, that's the sobering reality where we are. Alec, before we got a minute or so left, just I wanted to mention Contestant Urbana, but that really can be a life-changing experience. And maybe just say a word about people even start to think about planning on now.
Yeah, Billy Graham once said that Urbana was responsible, I think he said, for 75% of the people who went from North America in the last half of the 20th century overseas. That seems remarkable to me, but Billy Graham is Billy Graham. So in 2000, every 3 years, and the next conference will be in December of 2015 in St. Louis. It's the week between Christmas and New Year. And it's a life-changing event. It's 5 days. It's really, truly a missions conference, so speakers come from all over the world and share the needs of what's happening. I've been to five Urbanas. It's been life-changing for me, and I'm an adult. It's just fabulous.
You can find out more about that or any of the work of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship online. And what is it, just InterVarsity.org, or what's the best website?
Yeah, InterVarsity.org.
That's the place. That's the place to go and find out about the work of campus ministry near you. If you live near a university or college campus, know that your church can play a key supporting role in the great work that the campus ministries like InterVarsity are doing. And there's a real partnership that needs to take place there. So look into that and become engaged. And if you're in a business and want to get some perspective, Alec Hill's book called Just Business, Christian Ethics for the Marketplace would be a great resource. That is from InterVarsity Press, and get some perspective on holiness, justice, and love, and more. Alec, it's always good to visit with you. Thank you for carving out some time today, and blessings to you in the ministry. And we'll pray that God continues to keep the doors open for this vibrant work.
Well, Neil, thanks so much. And as we were talking before we went on air, I'm hoping Felix Hernandez of the Seattle Mariners has a great two innings tonight in the All-Star game.
That's, so we know we'll have a couple of innings watched anyway, if nothing else.
That's right.
All right. Good to talk to you. Alec Hill, President and CEO of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, joining us today on Connecting Faith. If you missed part of the show, you can always check out the podcast at myfaithradio.com.